distributing the future broadcast April 18, 2006, scaling games up.
The future is going to be bigger than the past. There's going to be more happening. Connected systems, connected devices, connected data. What can we do in that world that will be interesting, powerful, and useful?
Changing the world through capturing the knowledge of innovators.
The future is here. It's just not evenly distributed yet.
Welcome to Distributing the Future from O'Reilly Media. I'm Daniel Steinberg, and each week we bring you the technology and the people behind what you use now and what you'll use next. This week we're talking about games, big games. Amy Jo Kim talks about taking the lessons from game playing and applying them to your applications. And Jane McGonigal talks about scaling up intimate two-player games to where thousands of people can thumb wrestle. Distributing the Future is brought to you by GoToMeeting. Host your next meeting online with GoToMeeting. Everyone logs on to your meeting during your conference call so they see your computer desktop on their computer screen. It's like meeting in person, but less expensive and time-consuming. With GoToMeeting, you can demo products, present, or train just like you're in the same room. GoToMeeting has a low, flat monthly rate, so meet as often as you want for as long as you need. Try it free today at gotomeeting.com/DTF. That's gotomeeting.com/DTF. Why is it you like to play games? Maybe it's because they're interesting or challenging. Most likely, it's because they're fun. You're more likely to keep playing a fun game than one that isn't so fun. That may be obvious, but there's a lot more to it. At this year's eTech, Amy Jo Kim talked about five aspects of game mechanics that are used to make people play games longer and enjoy them more. These same mechanics can be applied to applications that you might be developing. She provides examples that include unlikely sources such as eBay and Amazon.com. She begins with an informal definition of a game.
What's a game? A structured experience that has rules and goals that's fun. Fun is the essence. So how do games shape behavior? Well, they leverage our most basic primal response patterns. At the bottom level, they leverage our competitiveness, our desire to do well, our desire to keep track of our progress, all those things. The one-armed bandit or slot machine is a great example that for understanding some of how games manipulate us into playing and keeping playing. There is a whole area of psych called behavioral psych, and schedules of reinforcement are about if you give a reward with a certain schedule. It can be regular, it can be random. It can be the same reward all the time, it can be variable. Certain schedules will elicit certain behaviors. And the red line there, which is called the variable ratio, is its nickname is the one-armed bandit schedule. That is the single most addictive schedule. Bottom line is, if you give a pigeon, a rat, or a human being sitting in front of a slot machine, an occasional, random, large reinforcement, and then occasional small reinforcements in the form of a pellet for a pigeon or coins for a human, that will produce addiction across species, repeated behavior. And games don't all use this, but they use variations on this idea. So how do game mechanics make an interactive experience more fun, compelling, and addictive? Today I'm just going to talk about five very simple game mechanics. And these are ideas that all of you can use and apply to work that you're doing. The first is collecting. Collecting is all about amassing your stuff and then showing other people your stuff. It's a very old, primal way of keeping track of how you're doing in a micro world. That is, in the world that's defined by people that collect the same thing. Those of you who have kids know, especially boy children, know the power of collectible cards. Some of us adults use that as well. People show them off. They carry them around. They have play dates that are all around showing each other the cards. How complete is your collection? You know, trading to get the ones that you want to fill it out. Well, you see, you don't have the trading mechanic, but you see a very similar dynamic in social networks where people show off their collection of fans, the people that admire them and wish to be their friend. Collecting is often based on the power of completing a set. Now, many of us are familiar with this from, say, baseball cards, collecting that. And if you've got all but two, you're going to work really hard to get those two. So that's a little bit about collecting. Now let's talk about earning points, which is a related mechanic, but it's a more abstract mechanic. So some points are just points, But you can also do things with your points and ask, well, what can your points do for you? If you're thinking of implementing a point system, there's many different kinds. One of the oldest and most powerful systems are redeemable points. How many of you remember or have ever heard of S&H green stamps? Okay. This goes way back. You would get S&H green stamps through purchases, save them up, paste them into books, and then cash them in. Well, we have the modern-day equivalent of that with, say, drugstore.com dollars. The whole point of this is to drive loyalty and drive repeat behavior. And one of the things that I've observed in my work, that those of you who are wanting to target females in the work that you're doing should keep in mind, is that one of the barriers for females to playing games especially, but also just getting involved in anything that's fun or frivolous, is that feeling that they're wasting time. You know, it's a truism. It's not true of every female, but it's largely true. Females are much less likely to spend hours playing a game. They feel like they should be doing something valuable. Well, if your system or your game involves redeemable points, you're a step ahead right there, because you get the feeling that you're actually doing something valuable. And I have to admit, when I shop on drugstore.com and I get my dollars, somehow I have this feeling that it's not just I'm buying stuff, somehow I'm doing something worthwhile. Can earning points be a social experience? Absolutely. Anytime you have a multiplayer system, whether it's a game or whether it's a trading system like eBay, your points are social in that they're visible socially and often they're given socially. Other people give you points. That's the only way you can get them. They can give you negative points or positive points. And the game is to amass as many positive points as you can and thus do better in the micro world, which is the trading system. Amazon has another interesting example of social points. You can write a review, which is not social points, that's just your review, but other people can rate your review of how useful it was to you. Again, going back to that point of expressing the values of the site, what that says is that Amazon really values not just someone who writes a lot of reviews, but someone who writes really useful reviews. And this is reflected in the way they organize the site. Flickr is a particularly interesting example. They've got something called interestingness, which is, rather than being a measure of explicit social points, it's a measure of aggregate behavior. Points are calculated by a combination of how many people commented on and viewed and tagged particular images. And what this gives you is essentially a rating system without asking the users to do anything other than their normal behavior. So, you know, when you're building your next applications, think about that. Think about, what are people doing? What do I want to reinforce? And how might I be able to develop some sort of measurement or point system around that natural behavior? Now, once you have points, you can also have levels. Levels are essentially shorthand for accumulated points. That's all they are. They're very, very motivating. Now, early on, eBay did something really interesting, which is they introduced levels on top of their point system. It's called the star system. And they did this partly to just make it easier for people to quickly recognize who's a valid seller or buyer. What they found was that exactly the same behavior that you see in games, they would see among their sellers. When people got to, say, purple star, then it was like, oh, I only need a few more to get to red star, and it was very motivating. It really created loyalty and barriers to exit. It was one of the many things. So the third mechanic I want to talk about is feedback. Now, feedback is not just common to games. Feedback is common to many kinds of software. However, if you look at games, what you see is very powerful, sophisticated uses of feedback at many levels. And by using feedback creatively, you can make your system more fun and feel more like a game. Feedback also accelerates mastery. Anybody who's ever had a really good coach knows that if you have somebody or a really good program that acts like a coach giving you feedback about how you're doing, you're going to get better faster. It's really that simple. An incredibly great example of feedback for anybody that wants to study it is Karaoke Revolution. Not just does it give you great feedback, it actually teaches you how to sing. It does something very real world and functional by playing the game through all different kinds of feedback on your pitch, on your timing. If you're doing well, your character starts to glow and your mic leaves trails. If you're doing poorly, you get booed off the stage. So feedback also makes an experience more fun and compelling. This is a mashup of Google Maps that many of you are probably familiar with. So why are Google Maps so successful? Why are Ajax applications so successful? They're more fun. They're just more fun to use. They give you more feedback. They're more responsive. You get feedback. When you touch the map, you get feedback. You move it. You grab it. It feels more fun to use. And whether it's more accurate or not doesn't matter. It's just more fun, and it's been a huge success. So the fourth one is exchanges. And what I mean by this are really social exchanges, structured social interactions. Taking turns in a game, giving and receiving gifts, really, in a sense, having a conversation is a form of a social exchange. It's very basic, it's very primal, it's very motivating to people if they feel that an exchange has been given in one direction to want to come back with another. It's an age-old manipulation technique. So social exchanges can be very explicit, such as chess. You're taking turns. That's built into the rules. It's an explicit exchange. Your turn. They can also be implicit, and those are in some ways the more interesting ones for those of us in the room building social systems. A really good example is ease-based feedback system. Now, there's nothing in the system that forces you to give feedback to somebody who's given you feedback. But the way that the system has evolved, this is expected. And if any of you have ever bought and sold on eBay, if you have a successful interaction with a seller, they will harass you into giving them feedback until you do. And they'll say, once you give me feedback, I'll give you feedback. It's tit-for-tat game. And it is not built into the system. It has evolved on top of the system as a metagame. And that really shows you how powerful these kinds of exchanges are in driving behavior. So the fifth one I want to talk about is customization. Again, this is not limited to games, but games are particularly good at providing UI and character customization, and there's a lot that we can learn from that for designing compelling apps. Customization, as anyone who's ever built this kind of system knows, increases someone's investment. An extremely simple example of that is an app I designed last year for Digital Chocolate called Metro Girl. And it's a dating advice app. It's got little games you can play with your date and things like that. But there's four personalities in it, and you choose the personality that you feel most reflects your point of view, and then all of the advice comes from that personality while you're using the app. Very simple, but the feedback we got from the market research was that people really liked that. It made it feel like it was theirs, like it was personal. eBay has something very similar with My eBay, which they've made really rich and useful over the years. So rather than just seeing the eBay interface, you can see just the categories you're most interested in and up-to-date information about all your buying and selling, and that becomes your customized interface. It's one more thing that increases your investment in using the site and creates a barrier to exit. A different style of customization is what I call automatic customization. Amazon is probably the first really good example of this, where your homepage, the first page that you see, changes automatically based on your buying behavior. They don't always get it right. Sometimes you buy something for a friend and it shows up and it gets all weird. Most of the time, it's really great. It makes Amazon feel more personal. It makes it feel more fun, at least to me. A lot of people diss MySpace for being butt ugly and loud and badly designed and, just ridiculously hard to take visually. But I think the point that I want to make is that for the target audience that uses MySpace, that doesn't matter. What matters is the extreme customization that you can get in your MySpace pages. You can put the music you want. It plays automatically. You can do whatever you want. You can make different colors, different fonts, all different kinds of pictures. And that really speaks to the desires of the people that use MySpace. So looking ahead, what do we expect to see? Well, I think we're going to see a lot more serious applications that feel like games. I also think we're going to see a lot more games that teach real-world skills, like Karaoke Revolution, that really truly teaches you how to sing, or Brain Age, that teaches you how to keep your brain active. And I think there's a lot of opportunity there on the web, but particularly in mobile.
Amy Jo Kim discussing what makes games so compelling in an edited-down version of her 40-minute eTech presentation. Think of games that you play at home or with a friend, small two-person games. How would you get 1,000 people to play such a game? What would be the point? Jane McGonigal's been studying these super games and thinks about putting more play in public spaces. It may seem as if these large-scale games are performance art pieces, but by the end of this segment, McGonagall explains the differences. She begins by explaining the word super gaming. It describes the type of games that she researched for her dissertation at UC Berkeley.
This term super gaming, the root super, appeals to me for four reasons. The first is because I would like games to be supersized. I'm very interested in taking, you know, small games and scaling them up, massively scaling them up, and thinking about the design challenges of taking, say, a very intimate two-player game like Thumb Wrestling and scaling it up for, say, 1,000 people. Massively multiplayer Thumb Wrestling is an exercise that I do when I do game design workshops, and it was inspired by an art group in Vienna called Monochrome. So my hat's off to them. What you do is you create a human architecture that resembles a network architecture. And there are all sorts of charts that you can follow. So, for instance, there would be a Kazaa peer-to-peer architecture that you could use to map and organize 1,000 human beings into a chain of people thumb wrestling in a sort of peer-to-peer distributed structure. And you do this in a public environment. A major part of the game is seeing if the players can actually organize them effectively and understand the architecture and figure out how every person in the network is connected to the maximum number of other players, and there are no nodes that are dead ends and that sort of thing. And then once you get them all connected, then, you know, the thumb wrestling is sort of secondary. But the idea that they could organize themselves in a physical space and create this, you know, physical manifestation of a digital structure. And then you just thumb wrestle, and it's kind of fun. Thumb wrestling is a very intimate kind of relationship. And one of the problems that I'm trying to address with super games is the scaling communities. So there's been a lot of discussion in, you know, social network theorists and about how it's impossible to grow a community past a certain threshold because we lose the ability to keep track of our relationships and have a substantial level of dialogue with they usually put the number at 150. But that's a linguistic-based model. That's based on the idea that the way we maintain our relationships is through words, through written communication or through talking to somebody. But I'm really inspired by primatologist Robin Dunbar's work on the evolution of language and what preceded it. Robin Dunbar, who's at Harvard University, has done research on the grooming habits of non-human primates and has argued that language grew out as a more scalable version of grooming, right? But I think through gaming, we can actually reverse that and think about physical contact, face-to-face contact, and gesture and touch and other non-linguistic forms of communication as actually being a more robust scaling mechanism. So you can get large groups of people and have a meaningful community experience through a node that is touch-based, like thumb wrestling, and or through having 1,000 people take over a 10-block by 10-block city radius, not allowed to talk to each other and tell them that they're part of a game, but only to communicate through gesture, through body language, or through facial expression, and to have this silent, wordless system of knowing each other and finding each other and forming a community that way. So the experiment is really in moving away from these very difficult to scale models of community and to move towards kinds of communities that I think we can scale. The other traditional assumption about digital communities and what we're trying to scale is that there's a mutuality of communication. So we're not a community if there are only a few people talking and everybody else listening, right? That's a traditional, sender-audience relationship. To be a community, everybody has to be able to talk to each other and there has to be a high level of back and forth, right? And obviously, in a group of, you know, 1,000 people, let's say I want to get 1,000 people in a public space, how many of them are going to actually be able to do a give and take with a high number of other members of the group, right? They can all sit and talk to one another for 5 minutes, but what does that do for the 998 other members of the group? Something that I'm trying to do with super gaming is to think about the act of being able to communicate and express, and everybody in the group having opportunity to do that, to try to accomplish that not within the group, but to create an audience external to the group, and so that the act of expression and communication is actually about having the entire group mount some kind of a display or message that attracts an outside audience. So there's always an element of spectacle or theater maybe, or, you know, high performance to super gaming, so that the gamers might attract you know, an online attention, so people blogging about them, for instance, and taking photos and circulating photos of what they're doing, attracting the press. So, you know, players of games that I've worked on have figured out how to work their way into CNN presidential debates, finding a platform for themselves as a group to communicate outwards. And then that's, you know, also, again, much more scalable. If everybody's contributing to this message, and then they can just broadcast it outwards. So the example that I like to use, that's a sort of a surprising example, is I think the ideal model of what I would like to do in gaming now, with a slight twist, is Orson Welles' War of the Worlds, and the sort of epic disaster of the radio broadcast where everybody, many, you know, tens of thousands of people mistook it for reality and ran out into the streets, and they were, you know, putting towels over their heads in a kind of costume, and they had these makeshift props to ward off the aliens, and they were doing impromptu, you know, end of the world church sessions on street corners, and they brought down the, you know, the New York City telecommunications infrastructure because they were all calling people and trying to, you know, tell them and verify and spread the word. And it was this great organized response that was very theatrical, and they left their homes. You know, we think about radio as being a very private medium. It's not something you experience with lots of other people. It's not social. It's not something that happens in any kind of public context, right? You know, if you are in a public space, you have headphones on. It's very private and personal. So they took this very personal, private medium that they experienced in the home by themselves and shifted it to this huge, massively social, massively connected, outdoors, in the public eye, public discourse, using all the technologies they had at the time to do this. That's the perfect play, in my opinion, with the exception of I would like the people to actually know that they're participating in a drama. And so some of the projects that I've worked on have a very explicit a sense of doing something like Orson Welles did. So the big alternate reality game, I Love Bees, which was a radio drama broadcast over 1,000 payphones in all, you know, 50 United States and around the world. And we made 40,000 calls to the phones and played the radio drama in little bits and pieces and had, you know, thousands of players show up at the same time in costumes, ready to fight aliens and ready to call on the whoever else was in the public space and enlist them in solving puzzles and accomplishing missions and challenges. But they knew they were playing a game. There's a lot of performance in what I do, and I'm in a performance studies department. But for me, it's extremely important to design my work not as performances but as games, and for people to understand them not as, say, performance art, but to understand them as a game. Because the structure of a gaming experience is especially conducive to a certain kind of it helps you accomplish something that I find much more difficult to accomplish through performance. So for instance, performance is very extroverted. In order to engage a much broader kind of person, I think that it's important to have something that can be introverted, something that you're not doing to get people to look at you. But through the act of enough people doing it, on a high level, you draw attention, but that the individual participants don't have to feel like they're performing for the public eye. So in a game, you can give somebody a clearly stated goal. You give them clear procedures and steps to take to move towards achieving that goal. They have a rule set that limits their action. They have a clear success condition that they can meet or fail to meet. So at some point, they know that they have won or they have lost. And there's some kind of metrics. So they can compare themselves to other people. They can compare themselves to previous engagements with the game, right? I find that this structure is perfect for helping people first make the transition from, let's say, an online moment to a real-world action. So most people encounter these games online. They get an email. They stumble across a forum or a website. And then they have to make the decision, is this something I want to follow up on? Do I want to go to this GPS coordinate at the date and time that's listed? Do I want to go out and find my local bookstore and do this task and take a picture and submit it? If you have a clear goal, and you will know whether or not you've achieved it, and it's, you know, prescribed in that sort of magic circle of play where you feel safe and you understand, there's just a high level of understanding of what's expected of you, and you're in control. You're the one making the decisions. In performance, you're following someone else's script. You can interpret it, but there's not as much meaningful decision making. You have to be, by nature, much more extroverted. You don't really get the same kind of structured feedback that you get in a game. And for me, it's much easier to mobilize large numbers of people in a setting where they're getting structured feedback and where they can say, I'm doing really well at this, and so I want to keep doing it, or I'm done really badly and I'd like to do it again, or I'd like to get more people working with me.
Jane McGonigal's work on Super Games recorded last autumn on the O'Reilly campus. Thanks also to Amy Jo Kim. Distributing the Future is brought to you by GoToMeeting, online meetings made easy. Try it free at gotomeeting.com/DTF. Thanks to all of you who've emailed in your comments, criticisms, and suggestions. If you have ideas to share with us, send email to future@O'Reilly.com. I'm Daniel Steinberg. Distributing the Future is a production of O'Reilly Media. Special thanks to David Bettino for composing and performing this theme. Visit David at Batmosphere.com. This program was produced on Mac OS X Tiger using Soundtrack Pro, Bias Peak, and Audio Hijack Pro.